This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Hope you had a special Memorial Day. And once again, we should always pay tribute every day of the year to those who gave their lives for our freedom. And a gentleman is in studio to start the day after Memorial Day, May 31st, 92nd birthday of Clint Eastwood, 79th for Joe Namath. Luke Bixson, all of 42 years old, candidate for the United States Senate, one of the most impressive young men in Louisiana, graduate of the Naval Academy, a fighter pilot, saw combat action, and he works for a major airliner. He's a pilot, and he's running for the United States Senate against John Neely Kennedy, and the election is November 8th. So do the math, and we are 5 months and 8 days away from the finish line. So it's going to be really fascinating to see what happens over the next few months. But Senator Cassidy has been raising money. He's raising money too. But Senator Kennedy has been raising it like nobody's business. At last report, over $14 million in the bank. And he claims that he's out of money and that he's about to be defeated. Luke Bixson, your thoughts about Senator Kennedy's alleged hyperbole?
Well, good morning, Jim, and thanks for having me on the show. I saw Senator Kennedy's comments about being out fundraising. You know, it kind of goes back to what our campaign is all about, and that's responsible leadership. And we're certainly proud of our fundraising goals. We do not have $14 million, and we certainly are not outraising John Kennedy at this point. And it's a bit irresponsible, I think, to frame something in that way and deceive donors into giving you money based upon a lie.
And you call it a lie.
Yeah, that is untrue. I wish we were. I wish it were true. But it is a lie to say that we are out raising John Neely Kennedy.
877-217-5757, your number. Talk@talklouisiana.org. Signature support for our program comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. And Robin Dow is producing. Now, the last week has been dominated, and for good reason, by the awful tragedy in Uvalde, Texas. The decision of the Senate Majority Leader, front page story in the New York Times today, Chuck Schumer of New York, to try for a negotiated compromise on new gun laws in the wake of the latest pair of mass shootings may prove to be a high-stakes bet on what happens. Representative democracy itself is on the line. It's at a time when faith in Congress and the Senate is in tatters in both parties, and President Biden's promise yesterday to the families of the shooting victims in Uvalde, assuring them that we will do something about gun violence, raises the pressure on a Senate in which filibusters and disunity have been the watchwords for some time. So do you think anything can get done?
I sure hope so. You know, I just dropped off my son at summer camp, which is not too far from here. He's 9 years old, and I cannot imagine being the parent of one of those victims. Obviously, it's a tragedy. But we can't keep doing the same thing and expect different results. And it's odd to me that when 90% of Americans support universal background checks, to include between the private sales of unrelated parties, that 50% of the senators lacked whatever it may be, lacked the spine or the courage or just doing the right thing to pass this legislation that, again, 90% of Americans support. And, you know, I understand what you'll get. You'll get a response saying, you know, Luke, passing universal background checks is not going to stop every shooting. No, that's probably correct. That's probably true. But how can we let a perfect solution be the enemy of progress? And it may not stop every shooting. In fact, it probably won't. But it may stop one or two, and I certainly think that's worth it.
You are pro-Second Amendment, but background checks does not negate somebody having a firearm. It just means if they have a background check and they're not eligible to get one, then they have a problem. But why is that such a hot-button issue?
Well, it's important to me. First of all, you're correct. I am pro-Second Amendment. I have taken an oath to the Constitution. I have administered the oath to the Constitution hundreds of times. I support the Second Amendment. I support all the amendments of the Constitution. But we have to be responsible about it. And I think it begins with universal background checks. I also believe we need to have states pass red flag laws. You know, you hear a lot about mental illness in this country, and that's true. But just identifying the problem without a solution doesn't do anything. if there's a mental illness in this country, then we need to do something about it. And I support red flag laws that can temporarily remove weapons from people who are going through a hard time in my life. And then finally, look, handguns in this country, you have to be 21-year-old to buy a handgun, but you have to be 18 to buy an AR-15. And I would certainly support raising the age to 21 to match handguns for the purchase of an AR-15. We saw that laws work. I mean, this most recent case, the young man who committed that awful act waited until he was 18 years old to purchase that weapon. The law worked.
The guy in Buffalo was 18 as well.
Exactly. Again, these laws will not stop everything, but they may stop one. They may stop the next one in New Orleans or Baton Rouge or Lake Charles or wherever. And I believe we have to, I know this. Mm-hmm. I know the consequences of doing nothing. We know that. Mm-hmm. We've seen the consequences of doing nothing. That is a choice we can make. It's just not one I agree with.
A listener, this is Tom on Bluebonnet, asks, what would you do if the NRA offered you a contribution? Would you take their money?
No. No.
And of course, Senators Cassidy and Kennedy have, Cassidy in larger numbers, so about $2.9 million, but you need every dollar. And some would say, why not take it if that's not going to influence your vote? But it's hard not to be influenced when somebody writes you a check. That's the whole idea.
You're exactly right, Jim. I would certainly, you know, fundraising is important in this, but like I talk about a lot, I stand up for my principles. I stand up for what I believe in. I support the Second Amendment, but I believe the NRA has been irresponsible with some of their rhetoric, and I would not welcome their money.
877-217-5757, Patricia in Magnolia Woods. Patricia, you're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Patricia. Do we have her? There we go. I think she dropped. So try again, Patricia. We had a little bit of a problem there with your cell, but if you call back, we'll put you first in line. And Luke Mixon, another listener, asked if you would be in favor of an outright ban on assault weapons.
No, I would not. I believe that gets real squishy and real ambiguous, you know, in the definition of assault weapon. And so, no, I would not be in support of a ban on assault weapons. I mentioned the things that I would be in support of, that being universal background checks, raising the age to purchase a weapon like an AR-15 to 21 years old to match that of handguns, and also implementing these red flag laws, which can temporarily remove weapons from people who are going through a time of mental illness in their life.
And another listener notes that some of the legislation under discussion also includes a cooling off period. For example, last week we saw a big rise in gun purchases after Uvalde, and stock prices for gun makers went through the roof. And some will say, look, we need a few days to put things in perspective rather than having people rush to a gun store saying they're going to take my guns away. Your thoughts?
Yeah, look, no one's looking to take anyone's guns from people. We're just looking to implement responsible solutions to a problem. And look, we talk about the mass shootings a lot, but the truth is, as much attention they get, and they should get a lot of attention, is that mass shootings account for less than 1% of gun deaths in this country. And I saw in the paper this morning that, you know, gun violence is now the number one killer of children under the age of 18 here in Louisiana. And a lot of these laws aren't just to prevent mass shootings. We know that at suicide is a large...
In fact, more people die of suicide by guns than homicide.
Exactly. And a lot of these red flag laws, I think, could help people who often take a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
But the U.S. does not have a monopoly on mental illness, and yet this is the only country in the world with this kind of a problem.
That's exactly right, Jim. Like I said, lots of countries... Not lots. Every country, every society has people who are struggling with mental health, and we must do something about it. But again, a problem without a solution is a waste of time. And just to continue saying, oh, we have mental illness in this country and not often a solution is frankly irresponsible. And I believe the red flag laws can be a solution to that problem.
And another listener notes that much has been said about the fact that the police didn't act quickly. That was a mistake, no doubt about it. But is that a diversion away from a bigger problem? We can argue all day long about whether the police could have saved a few lives, and I think they could have. But we're going to have more of these incidents unless we do something.
Exactly. And you know, I always say two things can be wrong at the same time. It doesn't have to be an either or. It can be true that the police, it looks like, may have failed in some, not, the police failed in that situation. I think that's coming to light.
19 cops didn't go in.
Yeah, you know, I always, you know, people ask me, you know, the Top Gun movie came out yesterday. I saw it yesterday afternoon.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, I saw it yesterday. It was great. We had a theater full of people for a campaign event. We had a great time. But, you know, people always ask me, hey, Luke, what makes a great fighter pilot? And my answer to that always is one thing. It's the ability to make a pretty good decision right now.
Right.
It doesn't have to be a perfect decision, but it can't wait 30 seconds. Things move fast and you have to act. And make a pretty good decision. And it seems like in that case, people were in need for the perfect, or in search of the perfect decision and didn't act.
And we will return in 90 seconds with more from Luke Mixon. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Navy fighter pilot, you graduate of the Naval Academy at Annapolis, Luke Mixon, and candidate for the U.S. Senate, the pride of Bunkie. He is in the House. If you'd like to talk with him, 877-217-5757. I'm getting lots of emails. We won't be able to get to all of them, but you can send those to talk at talklouisiana.org. He mentioned that he had a campaign event in which the new Tom Cruise movie, the sequel to Top Gun, was presented, and I'm looking the opening weekend. Global total of over $300 million. I mean, this is popular stuff. Must be a pretty good film.
I thought it was outstanding. You know, the I was 8 years old when the first one came out. I took my son yesterday. He was 9 years old. We had a, he loved it. And, you know, I always say there are, of my generation of fighter pilots, there are two types. There are those who admit that the Top Gun movie was the influence in them making their career decision. And they're liars. And I will readily admit that the Top Gun movie had a huge influence in my life, and I know every word.
Well, Luke and Tom Cruise kind of resemble each other, so hey, there you go.
That's awfully generous of you, Joe.
I think you're taller, though. David in Atlanta. David, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. It's such an honor to talk to an American hero such as you guest, Jim. You know, how could the Republicans get away time and time again with the big lie, like the election was stolen from Trump, and the virus can do bad things to us? The governor of Texas said about the murders in Chicago that Chicago has a lot of gun safety laws, and there's a lot of murders in Chicago, yet the governor of Texas never says the guns come from other states like Louisiana, which lacks gun laws. And they just get away with the big lie time and time again when the facts were proved the states with the strongest gun laws have the fewer deaths from gun accidents.
All right. Does David have a point?
Yeah, you know, it's much like Senator Kennedy's claim that he's being out fundraised. It's just framing things in an irresponsible way. Let's just call it what it is. It's a lie. We know that Chicago's a good example. A lot of those gun sales come from Indiana, and states with stronger enforcement or larger enforcement of some of these gun laws typically have lower rates of gun violence.
Rob on Lakeshore. Rob, you're on Talk Louisiana with Luke Mixon.
Hi, Luke. I think you speak very well, and it's a great credit that you are participating in the system, and I thank you for that. But I do have a comment on guns. I mean, guns kill people like a pencil flunks its test. You're creating a causation that just doesn't exist. So I thank you very much.
He has a point, but then again, guns are an efficient way to kill people, and some of these guns were designed specifically to kill other people in war, and they're out on the streets available, and Luke is not as far as some are in his party, is saying we ought to do away with assault weapons, which were banned in 1994, by the way, but at least we ought to do some things to make sure the bad guys don't get guns.
Look, I appreciate the comments. I want to make it clear. I am a gun owner. I am a 20-year veteran who has flown with a massive gun, you know, strapped on my airplane. I flew with a 9mm on our missions. I am very practiced in handling guns and firing weapons, and I support the Second Amendment. And I'm just asking that we be responsible with it. And I believe that the items I mentioned provide responsible leadership and provide responsible laws that most Americans agree with.
All right. Some other questions from listeners independent of this. The Roe v. Wade decision from the Supreme Court is expected any day. It looks like the law of the land for 49 years will be dispensed. And you've been a supporter of pro-life activity, but is this a bridge too far? Is the court on the right track?
Well, you know what I've learned the last, obviously this has been a big discussion in our campaign wherever we go, and I'm speaking about my beliefs, but more importantly, I'm listening. And what I've learned is that this is not a two-sided issue. It's about a 102-sided issue. And very rarely do I meet two people with the same opinion on it. A lot of people have different views. And look, we typically want to put people in a box, right? Are you pro-life or pro-choice? And if you want to put me in a box, sure. I consider myself a pro-life Democrat. I do support exceptions for rape, incest, and for the life of the mother. And oh, by the way, I also oppose these attempts, like we're seeing in Louisiana legislature, which are attempting to put or try, you know, call or to jail mothers and doctors for this. I think that, as the governor said, that's not pro-life either. And I find myself to be consistent on this issue. It's not just about abortion with my pro-life stance. It's affordable and accessible health care. It is, I oppose the death penalty. I oppose these forever wars that create so much death. And like I mentioned about the gun laws, I am pro-life. And then I think we need to do something about our gun legislation so we reduce some of these gun deaths.
And of the three major candidates in this race, you're the only one with military experience. John Kennedy is a Vietnam vintage but did not serve. And Gary Chambers is a guy who has not served in the military. You did. When we observe what's going on in Ukraine and the decisions on whether to provide aid for that country, does your military service benefit you in any way, or does it really matter?
No, I think so. I think so because I've been on the fighting end of our foreign policy for a long time. I always mention, I graduated roughly 100 days before 9/11, and then I retired, around about the time we withdrew from Afghanistan. So I've seen the results of irresponsible leadership. I believe that we made some poor decisions in that war, and that has benefited me. Mm-hmm. And I believe in Ukraine. I believe we're doing the right things right now. I believe our providing aid to that country, providing military aid, humanitarian aid, is on the right track. Help them fight for their freedom, for their country, for their wife, for their women and children. But I do oppose any direct U.S. involvement, meaning troops on the ground or airplanes in the sky in Ukraine.
You were 22 years old to the day, 9/11/2001, when America was attacked. Where were you that day?
I was in a flight school in Pensacola, Florida, when that happened. You're right. It was on my birthday. And, that single event shaped my entire military career. I always wanted to be a fighter pilot, like I mentioned, but I ended up flying over 3,000 hours in the F-18, a lot of that off of aircraft carriers in support of our operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. And, I was proud of my service there. But yeah, that event shaped my entire military career.
And here we are, more than two decades later, and we're still talking about it. And fortunately, we haven't had another attack like this in the United States, but it's a dangerous world. And what do you think is going to happen in Ukraine?
Well, I guess it's anybody's guess what's going to happen, but we're seeing Russia make some progress now on the eastern front of Ukraine, which is certainly disappointing. But look, the Ukrainians have shown their mettle. They are people willing to fight for their nation. They are an inspiration in their fight for freedom. You know, it's unfortunate that some of the things we're seeing from Ukrainians, we fail to see from our leaders right here at home. And I mentioned January 6th a lot. Some of those hearings are coming up. But Senator Kennedy was one of the six United States senators who voted to decertify the election. And, you know, it's funny to me that you see people dying for their country over there, for their freedom. And we had a senator in the form of John Kennedy who wasn't even willing to do the right thing to fight for our democracy by certifying our election. And it's not only irresponsible, but it's dangerous. You know, we live in this fragile republic that so many people have fought for. A lot of my friends have fought for. And the idea of someone not standing up for and for our democracy, the very foundation of our country, is very disappointing.
Stuart downtown, please be brief. Stuart, you're on with Luke Mixon.
Thank you, Jim. Luke, the audience, good morning. Luke, excuse me, I'm hoarse. Why aren't you in favor of banning assault weapons? Me and everybody I know thinks that there's no need for assault weapons, and there's very little difference between the mentality of an 18-year-old and a 21-year-old.
Some would differ on that. After all, we had a big change with our drinking age, but that's another topic. But assault weapons, you said it would be hard to distinguish. For example, when I was in ROTC, I was carrying an M16. That is considered by some to be an assault weapon.
Sure. I just think with the assault weapon ban, why I don't support it, and I would certainly be open to looking at any legislation as a United States senator, but it just gets very squishy and difficult to determine what is and what is not an assault weapon.
We'll talk more with Luke Mixon, and then we'll hear from Coleman Brown after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. We only have a few more minutes with Luke Mixon, candidate for the United States Senate. The election 5 months, 8 days away. Hopefully we'll have him back soon. And, of course, we are interested in having Mr. Chambers on. He's been out and about, as we know, traveling to all kinds of places, raising money for his campaign. And John Kennedy has not been on our show in a while. We'd love to visit with the junior U.S. Senator from Louisiana who is up for re-election now. A listener asked about Kennedy, who might very well be running for governor. Should he be put to the test as far as saying he's going to run or going to stay in the Senate if he wins? Is that an issue at all?
Well, you know, I suppose it's a legitimate question. It's one I'm not thinking about too much. I'm just worried about my campaign. We're working hard. We're raising money. We're getting out, reaching to voters. And I'm really excited about the enthusiasm we're seeing around the state.
All right. Allison Lafayette says she wants you to respond again to why there should not be a cooling off period for buying guns when there's panic after an incident like we had in Uvalde. Is there a cooling off period, a valid part of this?
No, you know, it goes back to my support for the Constitution. I support the Second Amendment, I believe. You know, I guess I'd have to look at exactly the detail of that. We have to remember that we have constitutional rights, and I think that may be broaching on some of our constitutional rights.
All right. Gretchen in St. Francisville, you got 30 seconds. Please go quickly.
Thank you so much. I just want to say that, Luke Mixon, you give me hope after watching all the pure evil with Putin and such, but also you're not only a courageous human being, but you care about the truth, and it is so vitally needed now.
Well, thank you for your comments. And you're right. I'm always going to tell the truth. I'm going to tell you how I feel and stand up for my principles. And, you know, we just, like I said, we can't keep doing the same thing and expect different results.
Let's see you again soon. And good luck on the campaign trail. Luke Mixon.
Thank you, Mr. Inkster.
And now we're joined in studio by Coleman Brown. He's an architect of renown here in Baton Rouge. Many have known Coleman as an activist of sorts for many years. And he is chairman of the Infrastructure Committee for the East Baton Rouge Parish Chamber, and that's not the Baton Rouge Area Chamber. The East Baton Rouge Parish Chamber, I believe, was the inspiration of my friend Lewis Elwood Woody Jenkins, right?
Right. That's correct. And well, we are basically a small business chamber, limited to under 50 members.
Well, there are all kinds of plans floating about, and of course, $300 million has been earmarked for the start of a new bridge in our community. And we need to do something about traffic, no doubt. But are we headed in the right direction?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. Maybe in the right direction. Anything to get some relief off of Interstate 10, which has been exacerbated by lots of Interstate 110 traffic refusing to take Airline Highway because it's been a failure for 30-some-odd years. But that's an inner loop that's been neglected sorely by the DOTD, and the city has had to pick up the tab for widening a state and federal road, which is the beginning of an inner loop. And many are talking about a south loop, which, of course, this bridge would be part of. And we're somewhat supportive of that, although many people are not talking about some other alternatives of connecting the existing bridges on the west side. The people in St. John, St. James have been coming to the state of Louisiana year after year asking for better evacuation routes, and what are the problems with DOTD wanting to spend basically $2 billion in gutting Baton Rouge again, is going to be a serious problem with right. evacuation.
Well, you have gone street by street, and you have some ideas about Airline Highway and College Drive, but of course, we have a show that is brief, but what would be your first priority if you were calling the shots?
Well, you know, about 2.5, almost 3 years ago, we finished the terrace exit, and DOTD, as part of that application in the federal process, 82-83% of the cars exiting at Washington Street in that application were coming from North Baton Rouge and cutting across. So the first thing I would do would be simply close off Washington and free up the 40 or 50 feet that's almost 2,000 feet long right there at Washington, and that would free up the daily afternoon traffic tremendously.
And, so just shut off the Washington Street exit?
Please. It would be enormously important. And since such few people of that, you know, maybe 15% are coming from Lafayette, Port Allen, if you will, going south, and the rest of the traffic is still cutting across Washington. We mm-hmm. counted the other day about two or three weeks ago, one car per minute, and that was something like a Saturday. So
on which exit?
On the Washington exit.
Yeah,
I'm
well,
sorry.
I take the Terrace exit, and I can tell you there aren't a lot of people taking that one either. And it really is a smooth drive into the Garden District. You can get there really efficiently leaving that Terrace exit. If you got to go to the other side of the, people are accustomed to going off on the right side. This one you have to go off on the left side.
Well, Secretary Wilson was had her planning 6 or 7 years ago when we submitted it to him, and he noted and took many studies that it would be very safe to do that. So
yeah, well, we do it with Laurel Street. I don't know that there's been right. a big problem, but it's a new exit, and you're right. You can take the Terrace exit, which is a few feet away, and go off on the right side as usual. But I would imagine there'd be some pushback if you tried to get rid of the Washington Street exit.
We have lots of friends and clients in that area, Progressive Baptist Church. We work with them closely when we were building the Terrace exit, St. Francis Xavier, others, everybody I've met in that area, with the exception of one or two public officials. Most of the people that live there are very excited about the new Terrace exit and could part with the Washington exit, but we're talking about 125,000 cars going through there, and you might be talking about maybe 8 or 9 or 10 people mm-hmm. that live over there. So, you know, it, sooner or later, DOTD has to close this thing off, and I think they're holding us hostage. What we learned the other day from
all right, well, we're getting into the minutia of a couple of exits here, and a listener asked about the larger picture and wants to get your clarification, if one is needed, about do you really believe we need a new bridge? Are you saying we don't?
Well, if someone analyzed the origin destination study, which I think was done 3 or 4 years ago, I think it shows that something like 5% of the east-west traffic actually goes to New Orleans. We've heard that from a few people, some previous guests that you've had on here, Jamie Setz with the Capital Region Planning Commission, I think indicated that to one of our members in a meeting with him. So, you know, that's a pretty insignificant amount.
Well, if we don't build a new bridge, where should we concentrate? Airline Highway?
Airline Highway is a simple thing to do, and it should have been done 30 or 40 years ago.
What should be done?
Well, only 15% of Airline Highway was widened 15 years ago, but you've got a 20-mile inner loop that's, hey, you have all the right-of-way in the world there, and the city of Baton Rouge has had to pick up $100 million of that cost, and we don't have enough money for a overpass at the at the Choctaw Railroad crossing, but that's about $30 million, and we think that would be a godsend in terms of having an inner loop. It would take about 12,000 cars off of the interstate, the way we calculate it. We also want to get them off of...
Another listener asked a good question. Why do we have problems with traffic that cities of comparable size do not? Why are we such a problem?
Well, I think...
And I'm hearing something coming from your phone as well, so we need to turn that off.
Sorry.
Sounds like sympathy for the devil with the Rolling Stones, but speaking of, why do we have a problem?
Well, we all know that the traffic lights are horribly unsynced. A classic example is Plank Road. There's about 11 lights on Plank Road, and I don't think any of them are timed. And that's triggered a cry to have a, what do you call it, rapid transit. I think they're going to spend $50 to $70 million on that when all they need to do is synchronize the lights.
Well, speaking of, I can get to the airport probably quicker driving down Plank Road than I can on the interstate. Why don't more people do that?
Jim, the last time I wrote Plank Road, not too long ago, maybe 5 or 6 months ago, none of the lights were timed. So I don't...
You're saying that if it were a better time, that more people might find it desirable.
Yes. And you know, those things are just woefully inadequate. I mean, now there's some funding with the Move EBR program to get the traffic synchronization done, but we're typically 10 to 20 years behind what we should be doing.
You grew up here, didn't you?
Oh, yes.
So did we have the same kind of problem in the 50s and 60s?
I think really not. Some of these lights are they're replacing them now, but it's my understanding that the lights have been failing. And they're just needing to be replaced.
But the interstate came through here in the early 70s, didn't it?
Yes.
And some people believe that's what caused all this. And in Baton Rouge, unlike other cities, people go from mile away, they hop on the interstate. Most cities, they don't do that. They pick their spots. But what can we do better as a populace as far as how we behave? How we drive, where we go, what we use?
Well, I'm not so sure. Things like Government Street, reducing it from 4 lanes to 2 lanes, I'm not so sure who's in charge on that. One time I was talking to the traffic engineer, and he told me they had started working on that project 2 years before anybody ever asked him the first question about it. So actually coordinating things might be a good way to start.
We'll continue a few more minutes with Coleman Brown after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Coleman Brown. Then we'll go to Admiral James Stavridis, who is an important man as far as what's going on in our world today, here and abroad. But Kevin in North Baton Rouge waiting very patiently for Coleman Brown. Kevin, I want to slide you in. Go ahead. Please be brief. Hi, Kevin.
Oh, yes, sir. I want to know why every time somebody do something in the black community want to try to do something different, why the white men are always putting it down saying it's not going to work. Everything Kip Holden did, they said it wasn't going to work.
Is that fair, Coleman?
I'm not really sure what I understand what he's talking about. I'm sorry.
I think he might be talking about the terrorist exit, Washington Street exit, but that's a topic for another day. Quickly, the DOTD plan, do you think it has flaws or do you think it's on the right track?
For 6 years, they said they could keep 3 lanes open in each direction during construction. And about 4 or 5 months ago, they began letting it out. They would have 2 lanes. Then about 2 months ago, it's now going to be 1 lane. When you enter and exit Baton Rouge, you've got the 2 lanes that go west. Well, they're going to convert that to 1 lane into Baton Rouge and 1 lane out of Baton Rouge. That's what us old timers call the cattle crossing, because that's where the cattle used to fall into the expressway park down below. So that is going to be mind boggling to our commerce. And it's probably going to cost us tens of billions of dollars in lost productivity and needs to be addressed.
We'll be calling again soon, but I appreciate your vigilance, and it's always good to talk with Coleman Brown. And we're joined now in our remaining time as we head for the final Horn with Admiral Jim Stavridis. He has spent more than 30 years in the United States Navy, rising to the rank of four-star admiral, supreme allied commander at NATO, previously commanded U.S. Southern Command, overseeing military operations through Latin America. At sea, he commanded a Navy destroyer, a destroyer squadron, and an aircraft carrier battle group in combat, and also holds a Ph.D. from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, where he recently served 5 years as dean. And the man who received more than 50 medals is here to talk about his latest work, To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. Good morning, Admiral Stavridis.
Great to be with you, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and this is a reminder of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book from former President Kennedy, Profiles in Courage. You've been following military warfare for some time, and it's something that's not for everybody, but it's what you have logged your career doing, and you found some incredible stories to convey to us, and I must commend you for it. But how did you come about this project?
I wrote the book To Risk It All, Jim, in part inspired by John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. And what I love about that book and what I hope I've achieved here is to tell stories, in the case of my book, To Risk It All, nine stories of people who have to make decisions under extreme pressure, and they have to make them right now. And just like Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage, shows you people taking great risk in the political field, this book shows you people taking great risk in the naval field. So it's naval history, but it's really a book that I hope would speak to anybody who has to make a hard decision, whether that's in an operating room, in an active shooter situation, at the scene of a terrible car accident, or in military activity. In all of those cases, mm-hmm. I think there are lessons to be learned from the book.
And I doubt that we'll be able to get to all nine of them, but when I was a young boy, I remember the Pueblo. I just turned week before 10 years old, and that was the talk of the world at that time. Tell us about the commander of the Pueblo.
So this is a man named Lloyd Bucher. He's placed in command of USS Pueblo, which is a very small, unarmed intelligence gathering vessel. And it is operating off the coast of North Korea. It's out in international waters, got every right to be there. Unfortunately, the Navy failed to provide jets in the air overhead, didn't have destroyers standing by. There was no combat capability to protect the Pueblo. And the North Koreans seized on this, came out, surrounded the ship, machine gunned it, wounded a number of the crew, and forced the captain to surrender. They put the captain in a terrible position, and this gets to making choices under extreme pressure. They said, in essence, either you strike your colors, surrender your ship, which of course goes against Navy regulation, Navy ethos, or we will kill every member of your crew and we'll sink the ship out from underneath you. He really had no effective means of resistance. He chose to surrender the ship. His crew went into terrible captivity. They were tortured for over a year. Finally, we negotiated their release. They survived, but he had to deal with a Navy that criticized him and felt as though he had failed to live up to the idea that we will never surrender a U.S. Navy warship, an impossible choice.
The book is To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision from Admiral James Stavridis. And you also feature a woman, Rear Admiral Michelle Howard, and this is something that is not so long ago, 2009. What happened with Admiral Howard?
Well, many of our listeners will have heard this story because it was made into a famous film called Captain Phillips. This is the story of the rescue of Captain Phillips. He's a merchant captain. He's taken hostage by a group of Somali pirates off the coast of East Africa. Michelle Howard is a one-star admiral who's in command of a task force that's fighting the pirates, and her job is to save Captain Phillips. She has to do this, take these decisions under the extreme stress of knowing that a hostage rescue attempt very often leads to the death of the hostages. And so she put together all the assets at her disposal, the intelligence, the SEAL teams, the destroyers, the big deck amphib that she was embarked in, the command and control networks, put it all together, parked her fears and her doubts at the door, made a very courageous decision, risked Captain Phillips' life, but she won. And Captain Phillips was rescued, and it turned out to be a terrific story. And by the way, she's happens to be African-American, and she goes on to be the first African-American woman four-star admiral. So she made a very hard decision, and it came out very, very well, both for the hostage and for herself.
The most contemporary story involves the USS Theodore Roosevelt, and this one deals with COVID. Tell us more.
Take yourself back 2 years to the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020. Captain Brett Crozier is in command of an enormous nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, the USS Theodore Roosevelt. Everything is going well. He's forward deployed, not in combat operations, but doing a typical forward deployment in the Pacific, deterring China. Unfortunately, COVID rips through the ship. Of the 5,000 men and women on the ship, very high percentage are contracting the disease. There's a great deal of illness. Again, early days in the pandemic, there's no vaccines, there's no boosters. We barely know to put on a mask. We're trying to socially distance. You can't socially distance on a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier because there's just no room. So Crozier sends an email telling the Navy, hey, you've got to allow me to pull into port, get my crew off. Unfortunately for Captain Crozier, this email goes viral. It's interpreted in a variety of ways that lead to criticism of him. He's not leaning forward enough in combat. He's not organized enough. And so although it's the right decision, and he saves the lives of many of his crew, he ends up losing his command and his career is terminated.
We're visiting with Admiral James Stavridis. He is the former Supreme Commander for NATO, and of course, NATO is in the news now. And before we get there in our remaining moments, you went to the Naval Academy, I think 1973, 18 years old. This was at a time when the Vietnam War was waning, but it was still going. And a lot of young men didn't want any part of it, as we know. What prompted you to go the route you took?
A pretty simple answer, Jim, and it's the family business, so to speak. My dad was a career officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. He'd fought in World War II, the Korean War, and he had just returned from a combat deployment to Vietnam. I idolized my father. I knew I wanted a career in the U.S. military, so I went to Annapolis. The only deviation is that I originally wanted to be a Marine infantry officer like my dad, but I came to love the sea. So that love of the oceans coupled with a real affection and respect for my father led me to my career and led me to Annapolis.
Well, it's a great American, Admiral James Stavridis, 37 years, I believe, in the U.S. Navy, four-star admiral at that, and as I mentioned, Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. How relevant is NATO in our remaining few moments here? How relevant is it today?
I think extremely relevant, Jim, and you need look no further than headlines. Here you see Vladimir Putin invading a neighbor, a big, important country, Ukraine. They're not members of NATO, but by working together as a NATO alliance, we've been able to slow the Russian advance across Ukraine. And I think deter Russia from, shall we say, further adventurism in Europe. The alliance remains extremely relevant, in my view. And by the way, it's not just poised against Russia.
We do have to roll, but it's an important book, To Risk It All, from a great American, Admiral James Stavridis. Signature support from First Financial.